It was the worst man-made ecological disaster in American history. A great plow-up of Midwest land followed by a decade-long drought. The result? The Dust Bowl. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll hear from Iowa State University history professor Pamela Riney Kerberg. She's featured in the new PBS series by Ken Burns about the Dust Bowl. Then, my conversation with Will Allen, an urban farmer who's working to eliminate the fresh food shortage in urban neighborhoods. He's the keynote speaker at the upcoming Iowa Organic Conference. Coming up right after a look at this hour's news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was the worst man-made ecological disaster in American history. A frenzied plow-up of Midwest land was followed by a decade-long drought. The result, the Great Dust Bowl during the 1930s. It was a calamity that nearly swept away the breadbasket of the nation. A new PBS series by Ken Burns called The Dust Bowl premieres this Sunday and Monday, November 18th and 19th, and joining us now to talk about the Great Dust Bowl in our Ames studio, Iowa State University history professor Pamela Riney Kerberg. She's featured in the new Ken Burns documentary. Pam, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
Let's start off, if we could, by listening to a bit of the documentary that sets the scene for us. This, the worst man-made ecological disaster in American history.
They had come to the far edge of the Great Plains in search of a new beginning, in the last place in America where a family could claim a homestead and build a future.
We had the best crop that we had had in 1929, and everything was looking up.
A sea of grass, once the domain of Indians and buffalo, disappeared beneath the blade of a plow.
I saw the whole country transformed in the sunset glow. All the brown prairie turned to gold.
But then, it was as if the land rejected them. The rains stopped, and the winds came.
We saw this cloud coming in, black, black dirt. And I'll never forget my grandmother. She said, "You kids run and get together. The end of the world's coming."
It came like a black wall, a tide of destruction that crashed over the broken plains, choking the life out of everything in its path.
From the new PBS documentary by Ken Burns, The Great Dust Bowl. In it, Ken Burns features interviews with 26 survivors of the Great Dust Bowl. Perhaps in our listening audience today, though, it's a long shot, there are a few people with a living memory of the Great Dust Bowl. If you're one of them, give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. We're talking about this the first half hour of River to River today. 1-866-780-9100. Also, perhaps you are the child or grandchild of someone who you remember telling you stories about their experience in the Great Dust Bowl. 1-866-780-9100 or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Pam, as a history professor at Iowa State University, I know your expertise is in social history. So tell us a little more about what it was like in the lead up to the Dust Bowl era in the 1920s. What were people doing on the land that factored in, that contributed, that created the Great Dust Bowl?
I'm afraid I probably wouldn't go quite as far as Burns has with the idea of the farmers actually creating all of the conditions for the Dust Bowl. Mm-hmm. That land is particularly prone to blow. It's very, very light, very, very sandy. And conditions during the 1930s were extremely harsh. Now, the part that farmers had to play in this was that there were lots of new farmers moving into that land in the 1920s. Basically, from the World War I years throughout the 1920s, all sorts of new people came onto land that had previously been largely used for cattle grazing. And there was a lot of land put to the plow that previously had not been plowed. But one thing to remember about it is that this land was probably a little marginal for agriculture just because of the amount of rainfall, the high winds that are very, very common in that area in the spring, the summer. During the 1930s, you essentially get a perfect storm. You have lots of land that's been plowed, some of it for the first time, and then you have this 10-year incredible drought with incredibly high temperatures that really hasn't been replicated since.
Mm-hmm. And so, to be clear about the area we're talking about, Iowa not included in it, though.
No.
But Oklahoma, Texas, 100 million acres.
Right. It was Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas, which is the area I'm most familiar with, parts of Nebraska, eastern Colorado, parts of northern New Mexico, a very large section of the southern plains.
What year, what date, what month was the first indication something terrible was happening?
I don't think there was a particular moment when people realized something terrible was happening. It kind of crept up on them. 1930 was a bumper crop year. They had the biggest harvest of wheat that they had ever had in Kansas in that summer. And then in 1930, the drought began. But the thing to remember is that this was a part of the world where there were a lot of droughts. And so having a dry year or two dry years wasn't all that unusual. Once we started heading into three dry years, and then in 1934 was a really terrible drought year, and the really serious dust storms began in about 1935, that's when people started realizing that perhaps this wasn't your usual drought.
Mm-hmm.
And between 1930 and 1935, there's not a whole lot of population movement in the area. People are hanging on. People are waiting to see what happens. It's between 1935 and 1940 that people really begin to move out of the area because of the persistence of the dust storms and the persistence of the drought.
In the documentary, there's one particular storm mentioned, Black Sunday in 1935. Can you tell us anything about that?
Black Sunday in April of 1935 was a really terrifying storm. I interviewed a number of older Kansans in the late 1980s about their experiences of the 30s, and I went into a room filled with senior citizens in the Dodge City Public Library. There had to have been 75 to 100 people in there. And I gave a talk and then started asking people about their experiences of that day. And virtually everybody remembered exactly where they had been that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
This was a massive dust storm that literally blacked out the sun.
And if you see the images in this documentary, still photographs of the time, it is no exaggeration to say that people thought it was the end of the world.
The 1935 Black Sunday dust storm in particular, I mean, there was a whole range of dust storm experiences. Some of them were just a little bit of haze, all the way up to the Black Sunday type dust storm. And that one, when it rolled across southwestern Kansas, which of course is, you know, where I interviewed people, those people all remembered where they were. My grandmother, who was not the least bit inclined to be dramatic, said that she thought it was the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And she had grown up in that area. She'd seen dirt storms before. This one was that much blacker, that much bigger, lasted that much longer. And it was really very scary.
What actual damage? Of course, a lot of suffering. Any death? A lot of livestock dead.
A lot of livestock deaths because of either breathing in dirt or ingesting dirty feed. In terms of human deaths, there was an outbreak of what's come to be called dust pneumonia. And most of the people who were affected were either very old, very young, or had recently been ill. And the problem was that there had been a measles epidemic that had gone through the area in the month before the big dust storms started in the spring. And a lot of people who had been sick with measles, particularly children, became ill with dust pneumonia.
Let's, Pam Riney-Kerberg is with me, Iowa State University history professor featured in Ken Burns' latest PBS documentary series called The Great Dust Bowl, The Dust Bowl. Let's check in with Rose, who's called from Muscatine. Rose, do you have someone in your family with a memory of this time?
Yes, I do. My father-in-law would tell my kids stories. He grew up in Wilton, And I was surprised. I didn't think the Wilton area or the eastern Iowa area had been affected by the Dust Bowl until Iowa went through our drought in the 80s. And the stories he told the kids were stories of the black, you know, clouds coming through in the drought and how it affected their crops. And I was very surprised to hear these.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, Pam, to what extent did it affect Iowa, or could people in Iowa at that time feel its effects?
Well, the drought in 1934 and 1936 was so significant that it also affected a large part of the Midwest. Iowa was involved, Wisconsin was involved, and people in Iowa would not have had quite the same experience with dirt storms, but some of those dirt storms out west were so big that dust fell on Washington, D.C. It also sometimes fell on ships at sea in the Atlantic. So it's entirely possible that farms in Iowa were getting dusted by dirt from the Great Plains.
And it's interesting, Rose, isn't it, to think that it would be safe to say that there is dust or dirt from that era still in our soil in Iowa. Would that be a safe bet, Pam? Pam, you first. Yeah.
It's entirely possible. Mm-hmm. There's dust from those storms still in the walls of houses in Kansas. I can imagine that there's still dust here.
Rose, thank you for that remembrance.
Yes, I think there's still dust in the house in Wilton.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe time to clean it up. Okay, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you from Muscatine for that remembrance, thinking about remembering the Dust Bowl. So the reaction of the people when this happened, when this went over the course of months and years, how did it shape life at that time in the affected periods?
Well, it was wearing. I've read diaries from people who went through this, interviewed people who went through this, and for adults who were experiencing this month in, month out, it was wearing because it complicated every single bit of your life when the dust was blowing. It might make it difficult to get dinner on the table because if you put plates on the table to put food on, you would end up with dirt on your plate and people would end up, you know, chewing dust for dinner. You'd have to get your laundry out on the line at 3 and 4 in the morning so you could get it down before the dust storms of the day began. If you owned a store, you were constantly cleaning. If you owned a farm, you were constantly wondering if there was going to be enough moisture for your crop. It was, I got the impression that it was in a lot of ways, not so much terrifying as terribly, terribly tedious.
And emotionally stressful, you would think.
Yes, it was. Just knowing that, you know, knowing month to month that if this keeps on, you're not going to get a crop, you're not going to be able to feed your family. It's a very, very hard experience.
Now, the Ken Burns documentary, which you're featured in, has interviews with 26 survivors of the Dust Bowl. You've mentioned that you've interviewed a number of them in the course of your career as a history professor. How many are left in the country?
Very, very few. A lot of people who remember this as children are still with us. The people who I talked to largely remembered the experience as adults, and most of them are gone. When I interviewed them in the late 80s, they ranged largely from their 70s up into their 90s. And of course, most of those folks are no longer with us.
In your interviews with Dust Bowl survivors, what stands out as some memorable moments or quotes from these people?
The one that I absolutely love that I heard again and again from people was, "We were as happy as if we had good sense," which is not exactly what you expect to hear from people who are going through a difficult, traumatic time. But a lot of them were people who'd grown up on farms, people who'd grown up poor, people who'd experienced a lot of hardship in their lives. And the 1930s were difficult, but in a way they were a continuation of many of the things they'd experienced before. And they were as happy as if they had good sense because they maintained their families, their communities. They felt a sense of strength coming from the people who surrounded them. And so there were all sorts of difficult parts of those years, but again and again, they came back to the family and community ties that made it possible to survive all of that.
Mm-hmm. And these are people out on the plains who are used to difficult times. They expected nothing else, which makes you wonder if the Dust Bowl would visit us in the 21st century. We don't have that as much, perhaps, as that rough and toughness in our spirit, do we?
No, and when I would sit around with them after the interview was over and I would talk to them about their families and their children and talk to them about, well, what do you think would happen if we had this happen again? Most of them would shake their heads and say, oh, I don't know. I don't know about kids these days. I don't know if they could handle what we went through. But so many of them grew up, I guess, what we would call really deprived. You know, to them, it was just how people lived, but they lived without so many things that we take for granted that for them, going with a little less was, you know, maybe not as hard as it would be for a lot of us.
This taking place during the administrations of Roosevelt, what did the government do in this case? Could they do anything?
Well, the government did a lot of things. For people who lived in town, there was access to federal relief programs, which gave the unemployed jobs and in return gave them, you know, a small check to help them get through these difficult times. For farmers, there was the Agricultural Adjustment Administration that essentially paid people not to grow crops. And perhaps even more important in this area was the Soil Conservation Service, which paid farmers to adopt soil conserving measures. So they might not be able to get in a crop of wheat, but the government would pay them to do conservation plowing. They would pay them to plant soil conserving crops, to put in a small irrigation ditch on their farm. There were any number of things that the government did.
And we know the reaction of the people was also most famously, we know this from Tom Joad in John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, some fled.
Yes, and the thing to remember is that that's only about 25% of the population.
Okay.
75% wrote it out, which I find absolutely amazing. But 75% of them dug in and found a way to make it through those difficult years.
Professor Pam Riney-Kerberg is featured in Ken Burns' newest PBS series, The Dust Bowl. She's an Iowa State University history professor. Tell us, before we have to say goodbye, a little bit about your experience with Ken Burns. What was the experience like being in this documentary? Of course, Ken Burns, the most famous documentarian in our era.
It was very interesting. I had no idea. I'd been involved in documentaries before, but I had no idea how many years went into Florentine Films productions. I think I was interviewed for this just about exactly 4 years ago. And it was 2 years ago that I went to New Hampshire to see the rough cut and to comment on the rough cut. This is a very, very elaborate and long process. And I was a little bit amazed by that.
Mm-hmm. Was it Ken Burns who interviewed you?
No, it was Dayton Duncan, who actually did the interviewing in Oklahoma City. And then it was Burns who led the discussion of the rough cut and I think did a lot of the final editing on the project.
When they were having you evaluate the rough cut as a participant, what were they most interested in? I assume historical accuracy above all.
Right. Historical accuracy. And were there any clanger moments that were going to cause distress to viewers who would know that something was wrong and it would help, that it would just simply destroy their viewing of the picture.
Mm, so the one fact that was not on would destroy the credibility of the piece.
Or the one picture that was wrong.
Yep.
So we were looking out for the pictures that were wrong, the words that were wrong, keeping an ear out for what and an eye out for whatever didn't seem quite right.
Which of the horrific pictures from this period do you think most represent the suffering, the human experience during the Dust Bowl?
Oh, I'm not sure I have a one picture that I think represents it all, but I do love, well, in a horrible sort of way, those pictures of the dirt clouds rolling over these small towns and the people fleeing from the street, knowing what's coming and that they'd better batten down the hatches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is dramatic. Almost as if it's not real, as if maybe it was created on a Hollywood set.
It sure looks like that, but it's not. It's quite real.
Tell us which of your comments or what parts of your comments were of particular interest to Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan.
I was one of the social history experts. They were particularly interested in the texture of day-to-day life and how all of this affected men, women, and children who are trying to live through this situation.
Mm-hmm. So specifics about the food you mentioned, getting a gritty meal in the evening.
Right. Daily life and the texture of daily life.
Okay. We'll look forward to watching the premiere of this new PBS series by Ken Burns called The Dust Bowl. This Sunday is the premiere, Sunday and Monday, November 18th and 19th. And thank you for joining us to talk about this. Pamela Riney-Kerberg, excuse me there, Iowa State University professor, history professor, featured in this Ken Burns documentary. And I want to thank you for coming into our studio today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I want to end with a little bit of music before we wrap up this segment. The Ghost of Tom Joad. This is music by Bruce Springsteen, based on that fictional character from Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. Henry Fonda portrayed the character in John Ford's film adaptation. Let's have a listen.
Man walking along the railroad tracks, gone some places, no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over the ridge. Hot soup on a campfire under the bridge. Shelter line stretching around the corner. Welcome to the new world order. Family sleeping in their cars in the southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. Well, the highway is alive.
When we come back on River to River after a short break, we'll hear about urban areas in the Midwest that are often referred to as food deserts, lacking in affordable and local fresh greens and produce. I'll talk with Will Allen. He's an urban farmer. He's working to eliminate the fresh food shortage in urban neighborhoods. He's a keynote speaker at the upcoming Iowa Organic Conference. When we come back, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Preacher lights up the butt and takes a drag. Waiting for when the last shall be first and the first shall be last. In a cardboard box neath the underpass. You got a one-way ticket to the promised land. You got a hole in your belly and a gun in your hand. Sleeping on a pillow of solid rock. Bathing in the city aqueduct.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Will Allen, an urban farmer and an international leader in urban agriculture. He's the founder and CEO of Growing Power, Inc. in Milwaukee. That's a nonprofit organization that seeks to transform the cultivation, production, and delivery of healthy foods to underserved urban populations. Will Allen will be the keynote speaker at the Iowa Organic Conference. That's at the Iowa Memorial Union on the University of Iowa campus, Sunday, November 18th and Monday, November 19th. Will Allen, welcome to our program.
It's great to talk to you today.
Some people may be thrown off or not have the best idea, a good idea, of what it means to be an urban farmer. What does that mean, urban farming?
Well, it means that we're growing food inside cities or or right on the edges of cities. And it's become a really big deal today for a lot of reasons, the fact that more people are moving into cities worldwide, and that it's really unsustainable to continue to ship food from far away. As a matter of fact, a lot of the food that we eat is over 10 days old before we get it into our belly. So developing a local food system and utilizing all the vacant land that's inside many of our big industrial cities around the country really makes sense.
What sort of science can you point to that food grown in your neighborhood or on the outside of your city is better for you than food that has been shipped in and is perhaps 5 or 10 days in transit?
Well, we know we have scientific evidence that shows that our soils nationwide are 50% less fertile than it was 50 years ago, for one thing. But also, when food is shipped, it loses a lot of its nutrient value. So we have the scientific evidence to prove that. So it's really important to be able to get that food into our bellies within a day, day and a half of production. And we can do that. Best case scenario, of course, if people grow food in their backyards or side yards, a percentage of food. I'm not saying that folks can grow all of their food, but if they can grow a percentage of their food where they live or in community gardens or access farmers markets that are all over America today, I mean, there's that industry has really grown. We really need to recognize that we're still losing our rural farmers. So we really have to support our rural farmers because, you know, when we have stressful times like this summer where we had a tremendous drought really cuts down. But the good news is the fact that today more young people want to start farming. And one of the best places to start because of the cost of buying a farm is in the city on vacant land, vacant lots, to be able to grow it on asphalt or concrete or rooftops using compost, of course, resurrecting the soil and not growing in the contaminated soil in our cities.
So you've got suburban areas, perhaps not found in Iowa, but I'm thinking of Detroit or some other places where you have vast expanses of places that are not of use for residential areas. You can turn those into farms and really change the face of the community.
Absolutely. I mean, if you take a city like Detroit, where there's 169 square miles of land, half of the city is not occupied anymore. So there's thousands of acres inside the city of Detroit that could be utilized in developing a food system, a local food system that would create hundreds of different categories of jobs if we do it right, and thousands of jobs. So we have that same situation in the city of Chicago, where there's 77,000 vacant lots and 33 square miles of vacant land. So it goes on and on. All these cities like Youngstown, Ohio, Flint, Michigan, Milwaukee, all of these cities have distressed housing that has to come down, and that space can be used to grow food. There's already space in all the vacant factories that have tremendous amount of land. I mean, there's factories and land in Milwaukee with 12 acres of land and 235,000 square foot buildings that could be used for aquaponics and aquaculture. Mm-hmm. So there's tremendous opportunities. And like I said, the good thing is these young people, under 40 group that really dominate the food system today that want to learn how to farm.
Right. And yet you're coming to speak in Iowa, of course, a big agricultural state. In a place like Iowa, where we named some places there with a lot of urban blight. We have an abundance of rural farmland, even surrounding our urban areas. Does that still make sense for us in Iowa?
Well, our organization works with not only urban farmers, but rural farmers in small towns. Small towns are devastated as well. I mean, there are folks in small towns that are on assistance today that used to be, these small towns used to be had an agricultural base, but now today many of those folks don't have jobs, and we need to go back to more diversified integrated farm systems, where back in the old days in Iowa, you had a farm where you had not only grew vegetables, but you had animals like pigs and cattle and so forth. But today, when you look at most of the cropland in Iowa, you see soybeans and corn. So we need to go back to those days where we create these small farms in these rural communities and really help those rural communities and attract young people to these communities, because otherwise these communities are going to be in bad shape, and they already are. As I travel the country, I see it all over the South, which is even a bigger problem, where industrial agriculture has really taken over the landscape of farming.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Will Allen, an urban farmer and international leader in urban agriculture. He's founder and CEO of Growing Power, Inc. That's an organization, a nonprofit that seeks to transform the cultivation, production, and delivery of healthy foods to underserved urban populations. He'll be the keynote speaker at this year's Iowa Organic Conference in Iowa City. I'd like to ask you a little bit about your background, your upbringing, Will Allen. You grew up on a farm?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm. My father and my mother were sharecroppers from around Aiken, South Carolina, that moved to the Washington, D.C. area in the 30s. And unlike many African-American males who did sharecropping and was moving for these industrial jobs in the North, my father wanted my brothers, myself and my brothers, to continue the family legacy of farming, which I appreciate today. I might have not appreciated back when I had to do all the hard work on a farm. But today I really appreciate all the skills that he passed on, that I'm now passing on to other folks. But I was also All-American basketball, high school All-American basketball player, and had over 100 scholarship offers, and I attended University of Miami. When I left the farm in 1967, I said that I would never do this work again, and I was going to go to college and get an education and play professional basketball, which I did after college, and never go back to the farming. I thought I was missing all my friends who didn't farm. I thought I was missing all this great life.
Was there a moment, wasn't there an event that changed your opinion on farming?
Yeah, there was a transformative moment. My last place that I played professional basketball was in Belgium. And one day, one of my Belgian teammates, his family had a farm, and he invited me out. They were planting potatoes. And as soon as I touched the soil and started helping them, it was something I realized I really missed, and it was some hidden passion, I guess, that I had for farming. And I asked the team to get me a place in the country, and that's when I really got back into farming. I got 25 chickens, and I started growing vegetables, and I would have the other Americans from the other teams come over during Thanksgiving and Christmas, because that was during the basketball season. We couldn't come home, and we'd have a big feast with the vegetables that my wife and I grew, here I was back doing what I did and my family did, was to grow food and share it with other people, family and extended family and so forth. So when I got back to the States, that's when I started farming. And, of course, buying a farm in Wisconsin was very expensive. So I had to have a farm job, and I did that working for Procter & Gamble in sales and sales technology until farmed, got up to 100 acres of vegetables, and kind of had two full-time jobs as I was putting my kids through school. And in 1993 is when I bought the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. So you spent a number of years working in corporate marketing at Procter & Gamble, and then started this company, Growing Power, this nonprofit. What was that like to jump off onto that idea and to grow it? Were you nervous that it wouldn't work, that it wouldn't catch on?
It was a kind of an evolutionary process, I bought the farm for selfish reasons to sell my farm produce. We're located between halfway between two freeways, interstates, and on a very busy street. And I thought that I could sell my farm produce on my 100-acre farm about 45 minutes south of Milwaukee. And about 2 years into the project, I helped a youth group who wanted to grow an organic garden, and I had some space behind the greenhouses on the farm. And we got a front-page story in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel back in 1995, and my friend said, well, you should start a nonprofit organization. So that's how I kind of got sucked in working with the kids. And it was never a planned thing to be doing what I'm doing today, to have 140 employees and 23 farms and 15 regional training centers and doing work around the world. Mm-hmm. So that was never a plan. It just kind of evolved and took on a life of its own.
Tell me a little bit, Will Allen, about the main differences between urban and rural food production in terms of the techniques that are used. Are there great differences?
Yeah, there's a few differences. I mean, in a rural farm setting, of course, you have to have fertile soil, and you have to add compost if you're doing organic farming like we do. But inside the city, you know, there's a lot of toxins in the soil. There's lead. These cities were industrial cities, so they're heavy lead cities. They have a lot of arsenic and a lot of other bad guys in the soil. So we have no tilling equipment. So all the farming that we do is on new soil. We grow soil. We compost. This year we'll compost 40 million pounds of carbon and nitrogen to create thousands of yards of compost. So we build beds. Our signature growing style is that we grow beds that are 36-inch wide, 24 inches high, and with 18-inch pathways between the beds. So that's what we do. We grow on asphalt, and we grow on concrete, on hardpan clay, on rooftops. So that's the difference. It's the cost is much higher. We have 25 acres of greenhouses now, and we're on our way to 100 acres of greenhouses in and around southeast Wisconsin. And we have 8 farms in Chicago and 1 in Madison, Wisconsin. So the whole thing is to really, we're at a point now after 20 years of evolving to this point, is to really quantify a lot of things. We grow a lot of fish. We do aquaponics to really quantify things like how many fish do you have to grow to support a $75,000 a year living wage job? How many hoop houses do we have to build to support the same thing, a $75,000? And what is a cropping? What type of crops do we need to grow to maximize the production in those greenhouses? We're growing at $5 a square foot. So we look at, instead of looking at farming in terms of acreage and hectares, we look at it in terms of square feet. Mm-hmm. So if we're able to grow food at $5 a square foot or above, that equates to, at $5 a square foot, $200,000 gross income per acre in an annual year. So that's really important, that every square foot is important inside the city.
How does produce, plants or fish, as you mentioned, or livestock produced in this way, how does that compare in terms of cost with what we see that is mass-produced and trucked in?
Well, you can cut costs. Part of what we do and the possibilities and the future of being very creative in growing food this way is to be able to, of course, when you run a business, it's all about the cost of production. So to be able to grow your own soil, to grow your own energy, because we use a lot of solar energy at our facilities, to be able to grow food without using fossil fuel, using compost to heat our hoop houses and so forth, using those techniques using a water catchment as we capture at our national headquarters 30,000 gallons of water off of our greenhouses and hoop houses. To be able to do that is really important because we know it doesn't cost $4 to grow a tomato, an organic tomato. So we need to the shipping cost, we don't have those shipping costs. Bringing a semi from Salinas Valley today is about three times the amount it was ago. Mm-hmm. So to be able to get rid of those shipping costs and be able to produce enough food, because it's important for us to increase our production, to really scale it up, to change the dynamics, because in a city like Milwaukee or Chicago, less than 1% of the food is grown within the local arena. So to be able to change that dynamic, and we think we can over the next 2 years to about 10% of local food, that's a tremendous amount of income for the local community and tremendous amount of job creation for the community. It's an economic development piece. And we're in a city where the politicos have really stepped up and helped us in terms of opening up policies that we can do this.
Besides the benefits that you just mentioned there, I'm sure that people can look at benefits that you can't quantify on a sheet of paper, on a spreadsheet. Having gardens in your midst, having greenery.
Right. There's so many benefits in terms of bringing people together in communities at a time where people just don't talk to each other anymore in neighborhoods. But having community gardens, having these farms in these communities bring people together. But the biggest benefit that I see, one of the biggest benefits, is good food is our medicine. So if we're able to get good food into people's bellies, they're going to be healthier. Our pillars of health are nutrition and stress management and exercise. And if we can get, and two-thirds of that is the nutrition part. So if we can get that fixed, when people start eating healthier food and we're able to get this locally produced food like we've been able to do into our school system,
right,
then things really change.
And, of course, getting out and tending a field or tending your urban plot can be relaxing and work against stress as well, right?
Yeah, it's really important because it's gardening is probably one of the most therapeutic things one can do. And to see the transformation of these kids in the cities where people always said those kids wouldn't, you know, many people years ago would tell me those kids won't farm, you know, not true. There's more youth gardens and organizations running youth gardening projects around the country. They've really kind of are responsible. These organizations are really responsible for the scaling up. And, of course, the First Lady putting a garden on just a 1,200-foot garden in the White House lawn to begin with really increased the amount of people doing gardening. They say, we estimate, it's over 10 million people started gardening when she did that. And, of course, the Let's Move campaign to end childhood obesity is probably one of the best things that any First Lady has ever done to really alleviate that problem.
You've outlined this vision for us. What is chiefly standing in the way of that now? What are the factors working against it that you need to overcome?
Some of the challenges that we have right now, we don't have enough soil. We have to grow soil in these cities. So composting and being able to overcome some of the negative policies around preventing a lot of folks from composting. Also, many of the policies of not being able to farm in all three or four zoning districts. We need to be able to farm in residential, commercial, and industrial areas. The other thing is to secure land for long-term usage. And now is a great time because land is very cheap. 10 years from now, we don't know if this land is going to be available or it's cheap. So now's the time to purchase land. So a lot of the the funding from foundations and so forth maybe should go to the organizations for them to be able to purchase land and keep it in agriculture or green space for years to come.
Will Allen, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Will Allen is an urban farmer. He's the founder and CEO of the nonprofit organization Growing Power, Inc., and he'll be the keynote speaker at the upcoming Iowa Organic Conference. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.